Thank you. So I've prepared kind of a mathematical talk because the subject I'm going to talk about is rather mathematical. But I hope that, at least at the beginning, the message will be clear, and then we can get into some of the math later on. Of course, there's much interest in quantum gravity and quantum information and how they're related to each other these days. And so what I'm going to do today, though, is I'm going to go back and try to explain the concept of extended phase space. This is a, if you like, a classical concept. And we recently related this to a quantum concept, which I'll just generically refer to as the cross product construction. And the main point that I will emphasize throughout the talk is that this notion of extended phase space is important. It's really a key to quantization because it allows you to represent symmetries, either gauge symmetries or global symmetries, properly. And anyway, so as I was saying, recently we saw a close, where we suggested there was a close relationship between these classical ideas and quantum operator algebra ideas. In the first paper, which was last June, we left a lot of details, particularly on the quantization side, unexplored. And the most recent paper from a couple of weeks ago that I'm going to try to get to today tries to delve into the quantum story a little bit further. Okay, and so what I'm going to show you is that the extended phase space ideas can be are very useful in organizing how you think about quantization, particularly in gauge theories and diff invariant theories. Okay, so there's many references of mine that I'm going to touch on in this talk. This subject, at least as far as I'm concerned, goes back to a paper with Luca a few years ago, where we studied, Luca, and then later a second paper with my student Pinchon, where we looked at diff invariant theories such as gravity, and we emphasized the role of embeddings of various types in the formulation of a phase space theory, in particular, how including embeddings into the story allowed you to construct integrable charges. And along the way, we understood the importance of corner symmetries. So this is in the background as well, although I won't really focus much at all today on corner symmetries. I'll remind you what they are, but that'll be about it. Okay, we then went further with some of my students and explored how to define extended phase space in generic gauge theories. So not only theories with diff invariants, but with internal gauge symmetries as well. And that's what I'm going to show you today, mostly. Okay, there's a pair of papers that I referred to on the last transparency that connects cross products and this extended phase space together. There's also a paper of Luca and Laurent Avai from last year. And as I'll mention at the end of the talk, this is sort of a useful example because many of the ideas that I'll discuss today actually showed up in that formulation. And I think now we have a better perspective on what was going on there. Okay, so as I was saying, the original implementation of extended phase space was to include embeddings of some submanifolds into the phase space of the theory. You might have in mind that we would be interested, for example, in the boundary of a spatial subregion. Generically, an embedding is described formally by a map from a space that I'll call SK here. What I mean by that is that it, from the perspective of the space M, SK has codimension K. So a hypersurface would be K equals 1, et cetera. You can think about that embedding as described by local coordinates, a local coordinate mapping. And we identified a maximal closed subalgebra of diff M from that consideration. And this is often referred to as the universal corner symmetry, and there are various subalgebras of that symmetry that are important in various situations. Okay, so from the perspective of K equals 2, the corner case, these diffeomorphisms, the diffeomorphisms that generate this group, are those that can become physical at a corner. So what we meant by that was that if you take a theory, a diff-invariant theory, like say the Einstein-Hilbert theory, then and ask what gauge charges might have support if you compute them on a corner. As far as the diffeomorphisms are concerned, it's these things that could have non-zero charges in a given theory. And anything outside of this generically do not have non-zero charge. Okay, and we then went further and argued that if you consider the context of covariant phase space, by including these embeddings, what you find that the diffeomorphisms are generated by integrable charges. Okay, so of course, codimension two surfaces are important in many contexts. A good thing to focus on is Noether's second theorem, which is the statement that given a symmetry, there is a Noether current J. Lambda, you can think of as an element of a Lie algebra if you're talking about an internal symmetry, or it's a vector field in space-time if you're talking about a diffeomorphism. And in the local case, what happens is that the term that I called M sub lambda here is actually the constraint, which is going to vanish in some sense. Classically, it would vanish on the equations of motion. In the quantum theory, you would impose that it vanish in some sense, perhaps on physical states or commuting with physical operators. And what I've called Q here, Q sub lambda is the charge aspect. And that integrated over a codimension two surface gives generally a gauge charge. Okay, so we're in a situation here where this is a good sort of organizing principle. And we want to understand, as I was saying, in what sense we can enforce M being zero. But we don't want to do it in such a brutal way that Q is forced to zero as well. Okay, we want to allow for that to remain non-zero. Okay, so let me show you a few details here. I've said several times that we're going to include embeddings in the phase space of the theory, and that came about as follows. So I'm going to describe this from starting with a Lagrangian point of view. And so suppose I have a Lagrangian density. Here I regard that as a top form in space-time. And formally, you might say that there's an embedding map of a region R into the space-time, and I'm going to integrate that. I'm going to integrate that Lagrangian density pulled back to that region R to form the action. Okay, and if you vary this action, you find the usual things where you vary whatever the fields are in the theory. I'm going to vary the embedding of R. Okay, and as I said, you can think about the embedding as described in coordinates. And so what I'm calling chi here, you can consider as a variation of that coordinate embedding. Okay, so what you find when you do that is that you on shell, you get the usual expression for a symplectic potential that has to do with the variations of the fields, but there's an additional term, okay, which comes about because in a diff invariant theory, the Lagrangian density isn't quite invariant. It's invariant up to a total derivative. Okay, so good. So then, given that result, if we choose a hypersurface, which again is embedded, I regard as embedded into the space M by a map phi 1, then the symplectic potential integrated over that hypersurface we write in this way, given the expression that we found. Okay, so you can regard this extra term here as an extension, and there's a corresponding symplectic form that you get by varying that potential, which is the usual naive thing plus some terms that come from varying the embedding, varying this chi field. So notice here that chi, I've written it with an underline. That denotes that it's a vector field in space-time, but I mentioned it's also variational. So you should think about that as a one form on the space of fields, if you include that into the space of fields. Okay, and sort of remarkably, what you then find is that when you include that embedding, you find that and in particular, you use that extended symplectic form, you find that the charges are integrable. Okay, so by integrable here, what I mean is that what I've written as eta hat here is a vector field on the field space that's generating the symmetry on the fields. And that specifying that then is equivalent to specifying a Hamiltonian or a function H on the field space. Okay? And furthermore, the algebra of the charges you can show closes on Schell. Okay, now I mentioned a moment ago that chi is a variation, a vector-valued variation. And in fact, if you impose the nilpotency of the variation, you find that, in fact, that's not an exact form, but its variation is given by a Lie bracket of the field with itself. And you might recognize that as a sort of ghost-like property of this field. And what I'm going to show you is that, in fact, that's very apropos. And I'm going to talk about a formalism where these fields really are related to ghosts. I'm not going to use the usual Grassmann formalism, but there's a sort of exterior algebra formalism that's very natural. Okay, so if you think about those as ghosts, in some sense you might think that what's going on here is that the extended phase space is bringing back into the theory degrees of freedom that in the absence of, in this case, the embedded corner, would have been pure gauge. Okay, and in fact, what I'm going to, the construction that I'm going to show you really, really formulates this in a geometric way. And what it does is it brings into the theory any degree of freedom that you might need in any given situation. Okay, so we're going to extend the theory in such a way that it has fields that can become physical in a given situation, or they may remain pure gauge in a given situation. Okay, so I focused there on codimension 2 because I was talking about gauge charges, their algebra, and all of that. But in fact, in the process of the discussion there were embeddings of codimension 1 surfaces, hypersurfaces, as well as codimension 0. Okay, and in fact, there's a general story there where you should really be paying attention to embeddings in any codimension. And one way to think about that is that everything I told you previously was really on Schell. Okay, so classically, the constraints, which remember are a codimension 1 structure, just vanished. if you wanted to go off shell in some way, then what you would expect is that those constraints, in fact, also represent the symmetry. There's a constraint algebra, if you like. And so the theory should be extended in codimension one as well. Okay, and in fact, as I mentioned before, the paper that I wrote with Luke and Laurent about null hypersurfaces for gravity, about formulating the phase space on a null hypersurface, actually had that feature. Okay, in addition to the usual physical spin 2 degrees of freedom, it also has spin 0 and spin 1 degrees of freedom. And we showed explicitly that if you just throw away everything but spin 2, you don't in fact get a representation of the appropriate algebra in this case, but you actually need those. You need the spin. In the case that we studied in that paper, we needed the spin 0 degrees of freedom. And so you can think about that as an example of the spin 0 being an extension of the sort of naive physical phase space of the spin 2 fields. Okay, so in fact, this analysis, so this was all about diffeomorphisms and embeddings of surfaces. You can extend this to any gauge theory. And you might be familiar with the argument that if you consider a gauge theory, but you focus on a subregion, then you will, this goes back to Donnelly and Friedel and perhaps earlier than that as well. But if you think about such a situation, you have operators that straddle the boundary of the subregion, and so you get physical operators that are charged with respect to the gauge symmetry that in some sense live on the boundary of the subregion. And you have to include those degrees of freedom in a unitary theory. Okay, so that story is much like what I described for diffeomorphisms. And remember that in the diff-invariant case, we sort of saw this physics emerge because the Lagrangian density is not generically diff-invariant. And so if you want to think about gauge theory from this perspective, a good test case is to think about Chern-Simons theory, which famously is also not quite gauge-invariant. It's gauge-invariant up to boundary terms. And indeed, so you can follow that as an example here. And what you find is that there's an extension of the theory that you can put in. There's a new ghost field, which now is valued in the Lie algebra rather than the tangent bundle as it was for the diffeomorphisms. Okay, again, this is regarded as a one form in field space, but it's valued in the Lie algebra. Okay, and so what we did next was we considered how to put these things, all of this discussion together, both the ordinary gauge symmetries and the diffeomorphisms. And here is where the formalism of a TLE algebroids is very useful, because as I'll describe very briefly, it neatly combines diffeomorphisms and gauge transformations together. And I would go so far as to say that this is really how we should be thinking about gauge theories in general. And it really is a nice formalism. Okay, so I assume you don't know much about Lie algebroids. Let me just briefly describe what they are. So in a gauge theory, you're familiar with the idea that mathematically what you have is a principal bundle with a structure group, which is usually some compact Lie group G. Okay, and that principal bundle is a bundle over space-time, usually. And a connection on that principal bundle is a one-form, you can think about it as a one-form on P valued in the Lie algebra. Okay, and you can sort of pull that apart. I said it's a one-form on P, right? So it has legs in space-time in the base, but it also has sort of vertical legs. And you can sort of regard that connection then as consisting of the usual notion of a gauge field, which we think of as a as a one form on space-time, plus a vertical piece, which you should think of as essentially the Fedeyev Popov ghost's degree of freedom. Okay, so that's the principal bundle story. As I said, the connection is really a one form on P. This means that it's a section of the cotangent bundle of P, and that's a bundle over P itself. It's not a bundle over M. But there's a closely related object, which is where you take the tangent bundle of that space, P, and mod by the right action of the group. You write that as TP mod G. And sort of remarkably, that is a vector bundle on M. And it has a rank, which is the size of the spacetime M plus the dimension of the Lie algebra. Okay, so and in fact, locally, if you think about the fiber of this vector bundle over M, the reason that these dimensions are here is that locally what it looks like is a copy of the tangent space to M plus the Lie algebra. Okay, and formally you can, and then there's also a bracket structure, though, on this thing, which is sort of inherited from the Lie algebra bracket and the Lie bracket on spacetime. And you can formally write this situation as an exact sequence where A is in the middle. And so roughly speaking, at least locally, you can think about that A as the sum of the tangent bundle and this bundle that I'm calling L. And L, you can think of as a bundle of Lie algebras. So at every point, there's a copy of the Lie algebra. At every point in M on TM, and there's, of course, a copy of the tangent space. Okay, so the point is that if I take a section of this guy, locally it looks like a section of here, a vector field, which generates a diffeomorphism, and a section of this guy, which generates a gauge transformation. It's an element of the Lie algebra. Okay, so you can put, so if I go back and think about the extended objects that we talked about previously, I called them chi and lambda. In fact, that's in one-to-one correspondence with a section of A. So that, you know, you can take that as evidence that this is a good way to combine things together. Okay, so maybe I should speed up a little bit. There's an interesting, there's much more structure here. There's some nice geometry on these Atiyah Lie algebroids, and in fact, there's a bicomplex. And in fact, BRST symmetry is included in the structure of this of the algebroid. And in fact, there's an exterior derivative that we call d hat on the algebroid. And there's a splitting of the algebra, as I was saying, into sort of horizontal and vertical pieces. And the horizontal part of d-hat, if you act on some representation, gives you the covariant gauge covariant derivatives, whereas the vertical part is related to BRST. Okay, so you can, anyway, so you can recast gauge theories, geometric gauge theories in this way, and you have the additional feature that diffeomorphisms are well controlled, just as gauge transformations are. Yeah.
If we were just doing gauge theory without diffeomorphisms, would we still do this, or would we not want to do it because we don't care about it?
Well, it depends on the context. I mean, sure, if you want to fix a background geometry and not talk about diffeomorphisms at all, then maybe this isn't for you. But of course, diffeomorphisms are important in field theories in general, right? For example, if it was Minkowski space, there are isometries that play a central role. So that's one thing. You have a choice in the formulation of what fields to regard as dynamical and which fields to regard as background fields. But anyway, you can essentially any gauge theory can be described in this way, where you have a choice of an algebroid a choice of a structure group, and in particular a connection, and then any sort of matter fields that you might want to build into your theory would be related to associated bundles of the and hence representations of the algebroid. Okay, examples of this is the tangent bundle itself. That's a trivial case where the structure group is empty. The thing on the left is just a rank zero bundle, and the algebroid is just TM itself. As I was describing, an ordinary gauge theory can be associated with a Lie algebroid where the structure group is a compact Lie group. And you can also think about gravity in this sort of formulation. It's more natural to talk about the first order formalism in this case, where the relevant principal bundle is the frame bundle or something derived from the frame bundle. In the usual formulation, it would be the orthonormal frame bundle, along with a matter field, which is a solder form, which is where the which is related in the usual formalism to a metric. Okay, and there are more exotic theories that you can construct in this way. So far all I've said is that this is a nice geometric structure. It has in it gauge transformations and diffeomorphisms. And in fact, what I want to argue is that the analog of the embedding in the diffeomorphism case should be thought of the generalization of that in this context is a morphism of algebroids. Okay, so what I've drawn here are these exact sequences for two different algebroids, possibly over different spacetimes. And you can see in the picture that I've drawn maps between each of the left, center, and right features. On the right, there's a map between M1 and M2, which is just an ordinary diffeomorphism. On the left, there's a map between the bundles L. Okay, this is just you can just regard that as a morphism of Lie algebras. By morphism, I mean something that's preserving the bracket structure. And the question is, the thing in the middle, what is that? Well, in fact, what you can show is that preserves the structure of the brackets of A1 and A2. It relates them in a simple way if the curvatures of the connection of the two guys are essentially the same. Okay, and so that feature suggests, because the curvature is essentially unchanged, it suggests that you might think about diffeomorphisms and gauge transformations as corresponding to such morphisms. Okay, and that's the sort of general picture that we have. Okay, so we're going to talk about such Lie algebroids with a connection, and we're going to regard the sort of generalized notion of a gauge transformation as such a morphism. Okay, and but we don't want, so in a physics application, we don't want to specify an algebroid with a particular connection. But you know, if you think about from the phase space point of view or from the path integral point of view, we want to consider the whole space of connections on such algebroids. Okay, and so in a sense, what we want then is we want some construction where we have a configuration space, which, as I mentioned, is well organized. You can think about it as the configuration space is corresponding to connections and matter fields that transform in a precise way under the symmetries involved. And these Lie algebraic morphisms that I was talking about are sort of the gauge group acting on that configuration space. Okay, so actually my notation is going to change throughout the talk, but for the moment, I'm going to refer to the configuration space as F here. This is the field space, if you like. And there's an action of this gauge group. In fact, it's important that this is really a groupoid rather than a group. And you probably don't want to know what that means. I'm not gonna emphasize that in the talk. But anyway, there's a group action on this configuration space. And in fact, what we did is we constructed a formal thing, which you can think of as a principal bundle and a corresponding Lie algebroid over the space of fields itself, okay, where the structure group is this group of morphisms. Okay, and that is what we claim is the formal notion of an extended configuration space and eventually an extended phase space. Okay, why is that true? Well, this principal bundle locally in field space can be just thought of as a product of the field space with the group. And so by extending from the space of fields to this larger object, what you're doing is you're including these gauge transformations into the field space.
Rob, I have a question. So the typical fiber of that algebroid that you have in the short exact sequence would look like a vector field in the space of connections, so an infinitesimal transformation of your connection.
By space of connections, you mean the field space?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
And an element of G, this G like that.
So that's right. So very good. So what's happening here is, so something in TF is a vector field on the space of fields. So okay. So it's like a variational derivative in field theory terms. And the corresponding L over here is like the Lie algebra here. And in fact, what I've written here is what I've specified here is that in fact what that is the action of an algebroid on the fields. Okay, so the idea is that the gauge transformations that I want to talk about are diffeomorphisms and gauge transformations of the fields. Those are combined into an algebroid over space-time. And so it's natural to associate the gauge transformations on the field space with an algebroid itself.
So an element of L there would be a chi comma lambda? Is that the point?
In a sense, yes. Because A is described by that. Any other questions? Okay, so good. Let me cut over some of the details here. At the end of the day, what happens is that when you think about the formulation of that theory, you find that there is a more Cartan form that I call var pi here. It's an invariant under the action of L. And if I introduce a Lagrangian density, in this formalism, the way that remember that we normally think about a Lagrangian density as a top form on space-time, right? Here what one does is one promotes that, you regard it as a top horizontal form on an algebroid. Okay, what I mean by, remember that an algebroid splits into a vertical and a horizontal, and the horizontal is like the tangent bundle of the base. Okay, so it's the same rank of form from that perspective, but there's more built-in structure here coming from the fact that I also have vertical stuff. Okay, so in the general algebroid case, I said that there was an exterior derivative on the algebroid here. In this context where I'm talking about the space of fields, we refer to that as delta hat. Okay, and if you go through the same sort of machinery that is standard in the simpler situations, considering that delta hat variation of L, which again has vertical and horizontal pieces, yields the equations of motion in the usual way, and you directly get an extended symplectic potential, which is of this form. Okay, and this is sort of reminiscent of what you have in a diff-invariant theory. Remember, we had an extension which was related to the chi field here. in that context. In this context, the role of the chi field is played by this Mohr-Cartan form. Okay, and because I'm talking about an algebraoid rather than just diffeomorphisms, that has both gauge and diffeomorphisms built in. Okay, so in this formalism, you just follow your nose and you get the extended symplectic potential automatically. Okay, so that's what I was just saying, and so you can think about this MC form as encoding the embedding variations and the gauge transformations. Okay, and then, you know, the things that I said about the diffeomorphism case are true in this general situation as well. You get a nether current, and you get a closure of the algebra automatically. Okay, again, what I want to emphasize, and I'll sort of use this way of speaking in the rest of the talk, is that so I've been sort of talking about a configuration space loosely here. I'm going to sort of switch my words into phase space terms because, of course, I have now a symplectic potential an extended symplectic potential that I'm going to refer to. So it's natural to regard things in phase space terms. And the extended phase space, as I was saying, I'm going to regard this as an extension of the naive phase space by the group. Okay, and again, this is because there's these extended degrees of freedom that correspond to diffs and gauge transformations. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, you might find this confusing because I'm setting up a formalism where I'm not referring to some situation like having a subregion with a boundary and focusing on the degrees of freedom at the boundary. Instead, what I'm doing is I'm setting up a formalism where I have an extension generically. And the way that I think about this is that where this structure becomes applicable depends on the context. Okay, so what will typically happen is that because I'm sort of including gauge transformations into the phase space, you'd expect that quite often those are just pure gauge degrees of freedom. They'll just go away. But they're there, ready to become physical in a given situation. So I think this is really the power of this formalism, where it's really ready for any situation. Okay, is that sort of structured? Okay, so let me briefly touch on the paper from 6 months ago. I gave a talk here, it was a group meeting a few months ago, but where I didn't show a lot of details, and I'm not going to show a lot of details here either. But the idea, in a nutshell, is that, okay, so we have this classical description of extended phase space. And what I want to advocate is that you can think about that extended phase space construction, the classical concept, as corresponding to a corresponding construction in quantum operator theory, which is the cross product construction. Okay, so in very rough terms, you know, you should think that, okay, well, if I have a classical phase space, when you quantize such a theory in some way, you expect to get an operator algebra. The functions on phase space become operators. And a symplectic morphism, something that preserves the symplectic structure on phase space, or preserves the Poisson brackets, if you like, should be an automorphism of that operator algebra. And there are special symplectomorphisms that are equivariant, or this is a synonym for the Hamiltonian property, the fact that they correspond to integrable charges. And there's a sense in which you could think about those as inner automorphisms of the operator algebra. Okay, so that's the sort of picture that we have of the correspondence. And so you can see that everything here is about how you represent gauge symmetries. The point of the extended phase space construction was that you you represent properly gauge symmetries or symmetries on the phase space. And in the quantum case, what the cross product construction of an operator algebra, of a von Neumann algebra by a group in general, is that it brings operators into the algebra. They become inner automorphisms generally under the cross product construction.
So, okay. Can I ask? Yeah. So, in the classical theory, going extended is a way to render all superectomorphism equivariant. Should I think in that?
No, it's not. That's not the case.
It's not the case. So there are simple ectomorphisms that don't have an associated Hamiltonian generator.
Yes.
What is an example of those in the extended space?
Let's see. So I guess I meant generically. I don't expect this to be the case.
Ah. Right. Okay. Okay.
That's all I meant.
So there's no way but proof that every simple ectomorphism.
No. Yeah. If I implied that, I didn't. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I was speaking. Yeah.
But there are more in extended. So as you extend, you render more simple ectomorphism equivalent,
yes.
And that's why you are associating it to a cross product at the quantum level because
right.
It renders outer inner.
Right. Exactly. That's the picture.
Sorry, do you mind if I ask a question as well? So in this quantization prescription you're using, what corresponds to the modular Hamiltonian in the quantum case? So how do you get the action by the modular group? Is it some like special simple ectomorphisms you're taking, or
it would be I'm not actually going to talk about modular automorphisms in this talk directly, but in fact, a familiar example, which is what you're alluding to, is
yes.
Of the cross product construction, is where you consider the modular automorphism.
Right, but you can have
in particular.
An analog of that in symplectic geometry, right?
Yes.
So is that like has this been made?
So in it, absolutely. So there are simple situations which we've studied for many years, for example, in Minkowski space, if you consider a subregion, then the modular automorphism or the modular Hamiltonian is realized geometrically as a boost
near
the
absolutely.
Right at the entanglement cut.
But you have a classical analog for that, right? Or
well, I'm not specifying anything here, right? But you might imagine that yes, if I make this. The modular by the cross product with this guy that becomes an inner automorphism in the classical theory. There should be such a
that
Hamiltonian.
Would be interesting to see actually the classical analog as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Do I really have 5 minutes left?
No, because there were some questions. We started 2 minutes late, so you have 9 minutes left. You can go wrong.
Okay, so good. So in that paper of 6 months ago, there's sort of this kind of vague suggestion that, you know, this is the way you should think about extended phase space. There weren't a lot of details. You know, people ask about, you know, there's gory details about how you quantize and all of that. The most recent paper is really our first attempt at thinking about, you know, how do you really quantize in this formalism? And so in the paper in December, in fact, we thought carefully about three different quantization scenarios. The first was refined algebraic quantization, which I guess loop people might be familiar with. This is sort of the Riggs-Hilbert space construction. BRST quantization, which hopefully is familiar to everybody. This is very natural, as I said, in this configuration algebraic construction because BRST is built in to the theory, into the geometric structure already. And of course, path integral quantization is also very natural. And what we realized is that when you think from this extended phase space point of view, all of these quantization regimens are very closely related to one another. Let me go back. So in all of these quantization schemes, in a gauge theory context, as I mentioned before, you know, you have a situation where you have a nether current, but there's a constraint piece of that, which I'm calling M here, and you want to achieve that be zero in some way. Okay, so you might say I'm going to project to physical states by forcing that operator to annihilate the physical states. You might dress operators in order that they commute with the constraint, etc. Okay, and while doing that, you don't want to do something so heavy-handed that you would kill the gauge charges. Okay, you want to keep those available. They may have non-zero values in a given situation. Okay, so I'm in this talk, because I have, 18 minutes left, I'm going to focus on the path integral perspective. And what I'm going to show you, it's going to be very quick, but one can interpret gauge theory path integrals as conditional expectations. In probability theory, you might remember that a conditional expectation is a probability distribution conditioned on some event. Okay, and so I'm going to sort of present gauge theory path integrals from that point of view. You'll see the details in a moment. But you can sort of think that the conditionality has something to do with gauge invariance of the theory. It's a choice of measure, if you like. A probability distribution is like a measure. And of course, the essential ingredients in the quantization procedure is to understand how or in what sense operators become invariant, how they become dressed operators, how gauge fixing works, etc. Okay, so again, what I'm really going to do here is I'm going to describe a path integral construction built out of extended phase space ideas. Okay, and we'll see that it has this nice interpretation. Okay, I think because time is short, I'm going to skip some of the details. Here I was going to explain that the extension of the symplectic form again can be thought of in terms of more Cartan forms, one in codimension one and one in codimension two, and if this is contracted with a vector field on the extended phase space, you get the constraints and charges automatically. So this is a nice structural element of the extended phase space. But as I said, I'll skip over that. Okay. Except to note that in fact this structure is something that we directly found, or at least in our account of the paper on null hypersurfaces that we gave in this December paper, you can understand what we found there in these terms. Okay, and as I emphasized already, the spin zero fields that play a central role in that construction are really codimension one extended fields. Okay, so good. So maybe I'll talk to my collaborators about the details of that, but let me skip over that. Okay, so what is a conditional expectation? So you know, generally, you can regard formally a path integral as a map from the space of functions on a phase space generally the complex numbers. Okay, so phi, if you like, is a weight or a state. Okay, and functions, the classical notion of functions on the phase space canonically become operators, as we said earlier, in the quantum theory. Okay, and so that what this map does, it's interpreted. If it acts on a function that I call f here, it computes the expectation value in the quantum theory. That's the usual canonical interpretation of a path integral. Okay, the choice of measure here, which I'm just calling nu, depends on context, right? It depends on exactly what sort of what sort of question I'm asking, exactly what is the state, it depends on the state. If you think about it as a, you know, as integrating over the phase space fields of the theory, you would impose some boundary conditions on the fields, and that would correspond to something precise in the quantum theory. Okay, in the case that we have local symmetries, we have to be more careful because you know the field space is too big. And in fact, I've made it worse, right? Because I've extended the phase space beyond what it was previously. And so it's even bigger than it is in the usual way of thinking. Okay, but you can, anyway, so you have to be careful about what's happening with local symmetries. That means that you have to be careful with what you take to be the measure here. And I'm going to describe how this works, and you can think about this as essentially equivalent to the Fedayev-Popov procedure. Okay, so that choice of measure has to do with the conditioning language that I'm using. Okay, so here's some details, and there are only three transparencies. I'm just going to show you very quickly the ingredients of constructing a path integral in very general terms on extended phase space. Okay, so I'm in a situation where I have a naive phase space X. There's a group action on that phase space, and I'm going to call that group action A. Okay, so you can regard that as a map from G times X into X. And remember that you can think about G times X as the extended phase space, right? It includes the original phase space plus the actions of the group. Okay, it acts in a very simple way. I'll just call the image A sub G of X. And in addition, the way that we normally think about things is that there's a projection from this naive phase space X down to the space of orbits of the group. Okay, this is the thing that Fedayev-Popov sets up, right? So for any point in the phase space, this projection will map you to a representative point on an orbit. Okay, as I said, this A map maps you along the orbits. Okay, and you can think about that projection as being invoked in a variety of ways. One way to think about it is that you could specify a function on the phase space whose kernel intersects each orbit once. Okay, so that would pick out a point on each orbit. Okay, or equivalently, you might think about that as a section of the extended phase space, which again, we're thinking about as G times X. Okay, and so in this group action picture here, what I'm saying here is that this section is just the group element that takes you from an arbitrary point back to the representative point that you want to specify on the orbit. Okay, so those are two different ways to think about doing that. Okay, and it's important here that what this projection does, you can think about that as if I take any function on the phase space, it will map me to an invariant function. Okay, and so the group action on the functions is just through the pullback, okay, and you can very quickly show that pi takes functions to invariant functions. Okay, so already it looks like, well, that's the thing that you need formally to talk about dressed operators, okay, which are invariant under the action of the group. Okay, you can extend the Poisson algebra on the original phase space to the extended phase space just by thinking about maps from the group into the original phase space. And in particular, there's a morphism that we called I, which takes a function on the original phase space and supplies a function on the extended phase space. Okay, I've written it here. It just employs the group action. Okay, basically all I'm saying is if you want the value of the function at g comma x in the extended phase space, you just have to use the group action to get to that point from the base. Okay, and if you think about this structure here, and I haven't spent a lot of time on it, but in fact, this is already resembling what in the quantum case would be a cross product, because you have a phase space, you have operators, and you have the action of the group built in. Okay, well, so what's a conditional probability distribution? Well, in fact, we can construct such a thing from the usual notion of a Fadeyev-Popov determinant. So I'm thinking about this thing as corresponding to a function f that describes a gauge fixing procedure. Okay, and I've written this as an integral over the group using a left invariant Haar measure and a delta function there. Okay, trust me, that's the usual notion of a Fadeyev-Popov determinant. And then given that, you can introduce a conditional probability measure. So I call that phi of g bar x. Okay, so it's a measure on the group conditioned on a point in the phase space, which I'm referring to as x here. Okay, this is a probability distribution because given the definition of delta, it's automatically normalized. If I integrate it over the group, I get the identity formally. And what's more, if I integrate a function on the extended phase space, what I get is, in a sense, an invariant function. Okay, it's the function evaluated at the point on the orbit. Okay, and this is a feature, actually, which I think is more general than the usual way that Fadeyev-Popov is described. You can regard this result as picking out a dressed version of a function on phase space, or a dressed operator, if you like. I think in the usual Fadeyev-Popov procedure, at least the way I usually describe it in lectures, is that what you should feed into the path integral in a gauge theory is a gauge invariant operator, of course. This is a little bit more nice because I basically can feed anything in and it will give me a corresponding gauge invariant version of itself.
Okay. Just a second. So the dressing is this embedding I? Where is the dressing?
Good. So the dressing comes through this. Sorry, I didn't actually write it out here. The dressing just comes from considering some notion of a projection from x to x mod g. And the pi acting on any x gives you a point on the orbit. And if I evaluate a function on any point on the orbit, if I construct f of pi instead of f, it has the same value on every point on the orbit. So it's in that sense that it's an invariant.
So the dressing is intrinsic to the bundle? Like it's just a function of pi, it doesn't depend on the choice?
It depends on the choice because it depends on a choice of gauge fixing or a choice of conditioning, if you like. Okay. That's, I haven't showed you all. Well, I did show you. Okay, so this way of dressing depends on this conditional probability measure that I introduced. And that probability measure depends on a gauge fixing function. Okay. Again, this is essentially equivalent to Fadeyev-Popov. This structure is a formalization of the usual. Okay, given the conditional probability distribution, you can construct a conditional expectation. Okay, we call that map T. It's a map from the space of functions on the extended phase space down to the functions on the original phase space. It's just using the conditional probability distribution. What it's doing is it's taking you from an arbitrary point in the extended phase space and projecting you to a particular point. Remember, z of x was another way to describe the gauge fixing. It's a particular group element that relates a point x to the to the square brackets x, to the representative point on the orbit. Okay, and then the usual notion of gauge fixing then of a function f is just given by composition of this map t with the map I that I talked about before. It just maps you from the value of a function f to its value on the representative. Okay, and so what happens is that if I have a weight or a state, if you like, on the original phase space, okay, so it's a map from the phase space, the functions on phase space to the numbers. Using this map T, you automatically get what we call a dual weight. It's a weight on the extended phase space. Okay, again, this is reminiscent of the cross product construction. If you think that this phase space will become an operator algebra when you quantize, then what I'm doing is I'm relating a weight on an operator algebra corresponding to X to something on a bigger space. Okay, and so the claim is that in the quantum theory, you can think about the weight that I've called phi tilde here as the weight that you induce when you do the cross product. In this case, by the group G, more generally.
I was going with time, Rob.
I'm almost done.
Good.
Sorry. I'm almost done. Okay, anyway, so compacting notation back, remember I was calling the measure nu earlier. If you just take a function on phase space and apply this dual weight to it and work through the details, what you get is a path integral over the quotient space of an invariant function with an appropriate measure. Okay, so that in very short words is the Fadeev-Popov construction, but again with a little bit more detail about what happens to the functions on phase space. Okay, so in the paper, it's always important to look at examples, and in fact, we learned a lot by studying these examples and formulating them in the way that I described. So there were three. Each of them are sort of fun from different points of view. The first example we considered is just a quantum mechanics problem. This must be in the literature somewhere, but what it is it's just the d-dimensional oscillator where all the frequencies are the same, and that has an SUD. It has an SUD global symmetry. If you like, each of the levels of that oscillator come in particular representations of SUD. And what we did is we described gauging the SOD subgroup of that. And you can study the corresponding quantum theory from all different perspectives. You can think about invariant states, you can think about invariant operators, and you can construct the path integral using the methods that we talked about here. Another useful and familiar example is to consider QED or Yang-Mills. The only slightly unusual aspect of this is that we're constructing this as a phase space path integral directly, so we're not using the usual formalism. The usual sort of second order formalism, but instead it's the path integral formalism. And the nice thing about phase space path integrals in this context is that the constraints and the gauge fixing really appear side by side. Okay. And finally, the third example is this gravity on the null hypersurface case, and the structures that we found there all have an interpretation in this context. Here, I'm done. So let me just make a couple of
more
comments. So you might think, oh, this is great. What many of us are interested in, though, is not restudying Yang-Mills theories for the rest of our lives, but we want to understand quantum gravity. And there's a problem, which you may be familiar with, you may have heard discussed recently, is that so in this context, everything works very nicely if the structure group is locally compact. Okay, and the point is you need a Haar measure, a left invariant Haar measure, in order to implement the group averaging and all of that. And the usual way that we think about the diffeomorphism group is that it doesn't have this property. And so it's not completely clear then how formulating gravity in this way will work. This is sort of what we're focusing on these days, and I'll make a comment about that in a moment. One way you might think about this is that, oh, you could introduce some sort of ad hoc regulator to give some notion of a measure. That's something that's been considered in literature very recently. It's not clear to me, at least, if this can be done in a different variant fashion, or whether this lack of a Haar measure is related to non-renormalizability of gravity in usual discussions. But one of the things that you may have seen on various transparencies throughout the talk is that in the extended phase space formalism, we don't actually have a group. Okay, the last part of it I described in very simple terms, and I referred to things as groups. But what you actually have is a groupoid, generally. And okay, so it's not clear whether this makes things worse or makes things better. Hopefully it makes it better. And as I said, this is something that I'm pursuing these days, because we discovered that mathematicians have been studying these things for a long time, and in fact, Lie groupoids have Haar measures. And so perhaps this is the way that you should think about the diffeomorphism group in the context of quantization. Okay, let me stop there. Sorry for being verbose.
Can you just say at the beginning, like, what you meant when you said, like, ghost-like, or these, like, for chi and for lambda? Exactly in what sense were you using the word ghosts?
So what I was referring to was, so if you think about ghosts in the BRST formalism, and you think about delta as the BRST operator, then the BRST variation of a ghost field is quadratic in the ghosts, you know, precisely the form that I was writing. Okay. Indeed, this is what I meant when I said BRST is built in.
Yeah.
The BRST transformation is, in a sense, a vertical translation in this algebraid.
So you mentioned at the beginning that there was spin 2, the spin 0, and spin 0 came up in the game.
Yeah.
You said you were kind of related to physics, but I can see spin 2 probably are gravitons.
Right.
Probably spin 0. Is it the memory?
Well, there. So. What we did is we wrote down a symplectic potential that had a bunch of fields in it. You know, where that came from can be discussed, but there's a simple sort of fluid picture of this. As I said, naively you would have thought that these spin zero degrees of freedom are pure gauge, that the real physical degrees of freedom at the end of the day would be the graviton fluctuations. But we have a formalism where these fields were there, okay? An example of the importance of the spin zero sector of that theory is that it's that part of the theory that gives rise to areas of in this context of codimension two surfaces. Okay, so you know, these days in the high energy community, area is a very significant concept, right? Because it's related, you know, people think it's related to entropy and all of that story. So you can't throw away spin zero entirely, but you know, somehow there's some background structures like areas, and maybe the fluctuations in those fields could be gauged away. Okay, so what I was saying is that when you actually take this theory and construct the Poisson algebra, and you ask, is the algebra of constraints, in that context, it was the Ray-Chaudhry constraint. If you construct the Poisson brackets of those, if you just took the spin two part, you can show that Luca can show that the algebra doesn't close. But when you include the spin zero fields, it miraculously closes. Okay, so I take that as an example of what I described here, where some appropriate extension of the naive phase space. You know, makes algebras well represented.
Can you say anything about how having a group weight would rescue you? Any hint, like, do are there any group weights which are not locally compact but which have populations?
I'm not going to say too much here because I it's something that we're just beginning to look at. But the reason that, I guess maybe what I can say is the diffeomorphism group really, so what is a groupoid? So it's a more general structure than a group. You can think about it as maps from one space to another. And in fact, diffeomorphisms are naturally thought of that way, right? Because they are maps between manifolds. Often we take the manifolds to be the same, right? You're mapping from one place in a manifold to another. So the diffeomorphism group does lend itself to an interpretation in that way. Apparently what's going on is that if I nevertheless try to think about diffeomorphisms as a group, then I get these problems with local compactness. However local compactness is defined in the groupoid point of view, apparently generally there are Haar measures available. Okay, so that's the, I think it's worth looking at. Do you have another?
So let's maybe stop here, but for questions, approach Robert so that people can leave.
Okay.